Welcome, everyone, to Season 8 of Underserved. Joining me for Episode 89 is Rob Moore, CTO at Churnkey. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Rob, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Thanks for having me, Andrew. Just shut down all the VS Code tabs for today, so I'm excited to just sit down and talk with you.
All right, you're locked in. So back in high school, weren't big on programming, but did manage to get a perfect score on your SAT. How did you do that?
So it was the first time I went through. Math was fine. And then I realized that my language was not where it needed to be. So I think I got about a 650 on that the first time and got to work. I read all the time now, but growing up, I was not a big reader. Still don't really have a big taste for fiction, but realized I needed to learn a lot of vocab that I had been missing reading. So put together 4 pages of vocab, just pure words, and studied that every day. I had one of these little mnemonics for each one, how to remember it, and went back. And next time, language was not an issue there. So
you graduate high school, you go to the University of Maryland, the Terps. What'd you end up doing there?
So I started as a math and physics major. Always have loved math growing up, just love numbers, stats, anything related. I actually did not get into computer science until after my freshman year. So it was something as a math major, you have to take a couple comp sci classes. I had not touched computer science programming. I know a lot of coders now, you know, they start very young. They start at 8 years old. I didn't touch them until I was 20 years old. And then after that computer science class, the following summer, I was doing an internship at Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab. And I was actually working in a wet lab. So I was there, sleeves rolled up, pipettes going, growing bacteria. And the guy I worked for there, Dylan Cunningham, was great. He had a bit of a side project on data visualization for a bio threat database. And he basically gave me the green light. I had some extra hours. You know, I'm an intern, summer intern, had some extra hours every day, and really got into programming that summer. So I was working on some data visualization. I was very green, just going in there, learning D3 at the time and figuring stuff out as I went. By the end of the summer, I decided, okay, this is something that I really like doing. And it's interesting with computer science versus math for me, and I think a lot of people, is I love math for the sake of math, whereas programming, there's not that element of loving it just for loving it. There's this part where you can build things, which is amazing. I can sit at my kitchen table and I can code for something that is going to be run by millions of people, right? So there's this aspect of it, which is you can't get that scale anywhere else, which is fascinating. But that summer, so I just sat down and I realized, okay, if I want to do this for real, I'm going to have to jump on it. So bought a couple textbooks. I've always been a book learner, so bought a couple textbooks and studied up enough to test out of the first year and a half of computer science or so that I could continue doing the math degree as well as the computer science degree.
But you also minored in counterterrorism studies. How did that happen?
That I did. So I grew up in Maryland, and in Maryland, there's a lot of these, you know, three-letter organizations there, in particular, the NSA. Always been interested in cryptography, and I thought this would be a great thing to get into counterterrorism for if I did want to end up working at one of these organizations, and ended up applying even after senior year of university, but eventually decided, you know, this is not necessarily the path I want to take. Still did some very interesting stuff there, very psychology heavy, but it didn't end up really changing my career path.
Now, you also did some undergraduate research with Dr. John Froelich.
Yeah, John Froelich, amazing professor, amazing researcher. He, at the time, was running the HCI, Human Computer Interaction Lab at Maryland. And he was one of the first people to really get me into software engineering research. And he had these amazing projects that were just very much a combination of hardware plus software. And the first time I heard him talk, he was doing this presentation on a smart water sensor that people would attach in their house. They would stick it on a pipe somewhere, just like the main pipe. And they would be able to detect whether you're using a sink or the toilet or a shower based on the vibrations in that main pipe. And from that, he would pipe all that into a smart reader where you could go on your wall and look at the screen and it would show you your water usage based on all these different appliances. And it was at that point, it was this combination of, okay, very real world, like practical stuff, hardware, mixed with awesome data visualization. He was just very enthusiastic about it. It was something that was definitely contagious. So I immediately said, all right, I've got to work with this guy. So went in. He was working mostly with graduate students, but had a couple of undergraduates, which he helped in his lab. And we did some really cool research around accessibility, and in particular, developed a combination of, at the time, what was breaking edge computer vision, plus crowdsourcing through Amazon MTurk. And what we would do is we would send these MTurk workers, so all these crowdsource workers, through Google Street View, and they would be able to label where there were missing curb ramps for accessibility purposes, people in wheelchairs. This causes a big problem. And it's something for cities, it's very expensive for them to do this. They need to send somebody out manually to look at every single intersection. They need to vet it. So for us to be able to take this emerging tech with Google Street View plus MTurk plus computer vision and combine all three into something that then made it 1,000 times cheaper for them to do was very cool to see.
That's cool. Now, you graduate, you get some job offers. None of them are really knocking your socks off. So what do you decide to do instead?
Yeah, this was interesting. I took a couple of plane rides up to New York, a couple of finance firms, ended up with a few decent offers. And this was coming up in December, so, you know, 5 months before I graduate. And it was really at that point it sunk in. I don't know whether it was I'm not ready for this or this is not that appealing, but something told me, all right, I want to keep researching, dig further into this, and I don't want to take any of these jobs. And at the time, I was having one of these, you know, quarter life crisis moments, and I'm saying, all right, what do I do now? And I start looking into grad schools, and I'm too late, right? All the grad schools, you need to take a GRE and you need to have applied 4 months ago. So I'm like, all right, what do I do now? So I end up looking at this program from Oxford, and it's a mix of computer science and math. It looks awesome. It's cryptology, not crypto as we know it now, mixed with game theory, mixed with machine learning. And it's a bit of this design your own program. So I said, all right, I've got to do this. So went to work that night, applied. I think I had like a week to get together the application and everything. Fortunately got in. And so that summer went off to England, which I'm still here now. And it was a great program.
And what did you study at University of Oxford?
Yeah, so it was about half research and half classes. And the classes I was focused on cryptography and machine learning. And the research project, it was interesting because you would either work very closely with a professor at the university, or you had the option to kind of go off on your own and do something and hopefully it works out. So I did this research project using game theory to better design standardized tests so that they wouldn't be as easily gamed. So to make it essentially more difficult for you to teach to the test. And it was this really interesting game theory model called the Stackelberg Security Game, which is used for like the TSA uses it for deciding where to place their limited security resources at these different terminals, because each terminal has a different threat level, right? Like some are more quote unquote important than others. But obviously if you just place it on the important ones all the time, it's very easy to game in the sense that you just would attack the one with zero security resources. So there's this interesting model to actually figure out, weight these, but also add in an element of randomness and add it in appropriate amounts to make it difficult to game against that. So ended up applying the same model for standardized tests.
Huh. Now, they had an American football team there, right?
They sure did.
And you played on it?
I've always loved football. And growing up, I played flag football, but I'm a smaller guy and was never able to play in high school. But then I go over to England, and it's really interesting over here because it's a mix of these really athletic rugby players who will just knock you down and Americans. And so I was like, all right, this is my one chance, right? So I've got 1 year here. Let me suit up and go play football a little bit. So ended up playing there. We had a great season. We got pretty far in the playoffs, had a great coach that year. Interesting, the most important game over here is called Varsity. It's Oxford will play Cambridge. And we ended up winning that one 49-0. It's the biggest win in history at that point. So yeah, it was really cool.
Wow. Yeah, American football seems to be getting bigger over there, and traditional footy seems to be getting more popular over here.
It sure does. Yeah, it's interesting. It's funny here. You go to a game, so they'll have a game at Wembley, and it'll just sell out basically instantly. So they had a Giants-Packers game this past year, and tickets were going like £400. But you go to the stadium and it's not like people that are Giants and Packers fans will go there and show up in jerseys. It's people will show up in Dolphins jerseys and Jaguars jerseys and whatever else. So it's just like fans of the game, which is cool to see.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Maris Consulting Group, embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's mariscg.com.
So your first job, though, isn't in England. It's back in Seattle, Washington, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So yeah, popped over here to England on a student visa. And then after that, did a bit of contracting work. So that's where I started just doing freelance stuff just on my own. I actually started on Fiverr and I charged $5 for 1 hour of software data visualization work, which is impossible to believe at this point, but it was that moment of, okay, this is something that I can do myself, right? And I worked very hard to do it and to kind of grow that and end up charging, you know, $35 an hour or something more reasonable still on Fiverr. But it was just that moment of, okay, I can do this myself and be able to find work and do good work. And for me, it's always with contract work, the interesting part is you get so much variety, which is difficult to find in a day job. Some day jobs, you're fortunate enough to get it. But it was really cool to get a lot of hands-on experience really quickly. At the same time I was doing some of that contract work, I did a little bit of work for this company called Wave, W-A-V-V-E. And at the time, Wave was two guys working on a audiogram creator. So it's a podcast marketing tool for creating videos from audio. So you upload your audio, a little clip of your podcast, and it'll create a video with a small waveform animation. You've probably seen these on the internet. So they contracted me to actually add some new visualizations to that. So they had some basic waveforms and they wanted to do something more creative. So they contracted me to do that. And I was working on that part-time. And at the same time, I said, okay, I've got some debt from going to school. Let me pay this off more quickly because the contract work isn't getting it done. So I continued to work on Wave part-time. And at the same time, went over to Seattle to work with a small startup. It was about 20, 30 people. And that startup was called Live Stories. It was another data visualization focused startup, basically providing publicly available data from the census and from a couple of other sources and making that available for small local governments to analyze and to publish articles from that data.
Now, you had also met your wife in the UK, right?
I sure did. I met her about halfway through my time at Oxford and ended up not being able to stay because of the visa situation. But she went to Paris and Italy at some point in her last year studying languages. So I said, you know what, that's something I can tag along for. So spent about 3 months in Paris and then 3 months in Siena, Italy, which is an amazing place. It's picturesque Tuscany, beautiful little Italian city. Absolutely loved it there.
So while you're at Wave, you've got a kind of interesting problem where you have to take these videos to render, but figure out how to divide and conquer and do it cheaply.
Yeah, this was a bit of a David and Goliath problem the entire time with Wave. There was another company called Headliner, which does essentially the same thing as Wave, creates audiograms. And they had, I believe, $10 million in funding. And we very quickly realized that we need to lean into what we're good at and we need to niche down as much as possible. And one of these problems that is inherent in generating video is that generating video at scale is a difficult problem. At the same time that we are developing this, AWS Lambda serverless technology was taking off. And this just seemed like a perfect fit for it. So we redeveloped video rendering technology to be entirely on serverless technology. And this was something where instead of having an EC2 instance, which would run through the video rendering job and create a video one by one and kind of having a queuing system work from that, and we changed it to be able to create many videos in parallel and basically have infinite scalability through AWS. And what it would do is it would take these video clips and it would take the audio from them and analyze the audio and decide how big the waveform needs to be to animate it. And then it will break it up into 4 to 6 second chunks of audio and send off each one of those chunks to a different Lambda service. And each Lambda service would go and draw those frames for the video and create a little stitch together video. And then there would be another Lambda function that would come together and stitch all those together. And it was just it was mind blown because not only was it probably 20 times faster to generate these videos, but it was at least 10 times cheaper. We went from scaling up EC2 instances manually, like, all right, we're going 2, 4, 8 EC2 instances, to now Lambda's running. I don't even have to look at it ever. It's just going to scale up. And the bill comes in at the end of the month and it's, you know, $200 instead of $4,000. It's just like, wow, this was a great choice. So it's very much something where with small teams, you have to do something that is got a definite ROI to it, right? We don't have infinite money in the bank. We know that we're spending at that time, which was a substantial portion of our income on server costs. So what can we do to improve that and at the same time improve the product, right? People come and they just recorded this long podcast. They don't want to spend a lot of time going and creating the videos for it. So we saw that as a pain point for podcasters. At the same time, it was definitely ROI in the sense that we're going to be spending less money on it. So what we continue to come back to in the Wave days was just, you know, lean into our strengths and at the same time deliver real value that is hopefully solving hard problems. Because the more hard problems that we solved, the more it's going to be difficult for even these big companies with a lot of resources to solve that same problem.
Now you're developing all this Lambda stuff and microservice type architecture. Does that give you the idea for Flume?
A little bit. So my idea for Flume and a little bit of background on this is I saw that building out Wave and doing this contract work, and it ended up being a lot of the same thing over and over and over again. I would build an app, skeleton app, you know, plus authentication, plus billing, plus subscription. And I think as developers, I think it's natural to have this idea that you can build something awesome and, you know, build it and they will come. And that's always been the dream, kind of, is that people can focus 100% on building awesome products and not have to worry about the billing or the marketing or any of this. So the entire idea with Flume would be that it was a marketplace to buy and sell software microservices. So if you wanted to offer something like an audiogram video generator, you could just create the API for it and everything else would be taken care of. You know, people would pay $2 or $10 a month to do it. Some of the other popular ones on there was, there's one that takes a tweet and turns it into a video that looks like somebody's typing out the tweet. So if you wanted to do, there's hundreds of ideas around these little microservices. And I wanted to make it very easy for indie developers to make a living off of building these small but useful services. And what I ran into with Flume is I was mostly working on that solo and it was bootstrapped, no funding. Tackling the tech for that was difficult, but not impossible. So that was fine, figuring out a way for people to have an arbitrary API and hook it up and respond and fulfill these services. So that's a difficult problem, but solvable. The issue that I ran into was the marketplace side. So with the marketplace, obviously you need buyers and sellers, and trying to do that both at the same time as a solo founder with no funding was not possible. It was not tenable. So I built out probably 10 or 12 of these different microservices that people would come and sometimes use. And there were some that got quite popular. I think there's 300,000 signups on the buyer side, but a lot of people don't want to get out their credit card to pay $2 for something. And on the developer side, the seller side, it was difficult to talk people into listing their service on here. A lot of developers want to build up their website. That's kind of the fun part of playing startup, is doing the branding, developing the website. And to take that away from them, I think, is even at the hope of giving them a marketing boost, it's a difficult thing to weigh out as a developer. So I think, yeah, the two big wrong assumptions I made there were marketplace as a solo founder with zero funding is not tenable, and developers' hesitancy to list their product solely on a third party.
Yeah, and from a consumption perspective, like whenever a developer at a small company is like, all right, I need to build or buy this thing, how much time would it take me to build it? How much flexibility do I get if I do that? What will it be like to maintain? Or if I buy or lease, can I trust that to be around? Like, will it be of high quality? And there's definitely some hesitancy, like the not invented here syndrome.
Yeah, and it's something that's, as I've been CTO of Churnkey, is very become more clear as I'm making these decisions of whether or not to use existing technology, you know, buy it or build it. And so much so, more than a matter of time or even a matter of money, is it's a matter of energy, right? So like, do I have it in me to learn this new API for this thing that I'm going to use for one project, right? So it's not necessarily that you're replacing all of the work that it would take to build this yourself. You're adding work by they need to learn this new API. So I think what I found for the last year or two is that the tools that I gravitate towards are the ones that are offer very simple value proposition, are clearly very easy to integrate with. So there's a big cost to learning these products. And I think there might be a trend in the future towards very simple products. For instance, I'll mention one called LogSnag. And the entire premise of this product is just that it's very simple logging. It's API based. You send an HTTP request and it creates a log. And it's like, okay, what does this really add? But compared with like Sentry, where it's got this bloated UI and it's got energy to learning it, right? So if you've got this thing that takes less energy to learning it, I think that in itself can be a big advantage.
Yeah, and you could probably wrap it and swap it out if you ever needed to upsize something else.
Yeah, there's very little lock-in risk to it. Exactly.
Syrinx has spent a lot of time and effort over the past 25 years building our reputation for quality and our brand. There was one big problem, though. No one could pronounce our name correctly.
Person on the street, brand testing, take one. Hey, can you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx?
That's a really good guess.
Really?
Now, how would you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx?
Not even close. Can you pronounce the name of this company?
Syrinx.
Luckily for us, Syrinx was acquired in 2022 by the DeWinter Group. We're rebranding Syrinx under DeWinter's highly regarded technology consulting arm, Maris Consulting Group. We bring Syrinx's deep technology delivery experience, and they bring broader delivery capabilities and a new identity as Maris.
Here's what you can count on from the unified Maris. We are now a nationwide powerhouse when it comes to technology consulting, from DevOps to developers, to project managers, to business systems.
So join me in welcoming our future as Maris. Hopefully people will have an easier time pronouncing this one.
How would you pronounce the name of this company?
Maris.
How would you pronounce the name of this company?
Maurice.
Is that your uncle's name? Can you pronounce the name of this company?
Mars.
That's a planet.
Maybe not.
So contact Maris today, and we'll help you get your project done on time and on budget. You can call us at 408-297-7500, or you can find us on the web at mariscg.com. That's MARISCG.com. Now, you have a side project that you do with a friend. It's called per36.com. First, I'll ask you, what does the name mean?
Yeah, so basketball stats a lot of times are broken down per 36 minutes played. So instead of doing like per game stats or per season stats, they do per 36 minutes played, just as a way to normalize the players that play, you know, 40 minutes a game versus players that play 12 minutes a game.
Ah, okay. And so what are you doing with per 36?
I have always been a sports data nerd. I remember when I was 6 years old, every Sunday morning I would run out onto a freezing cold driveway, my bare feet, to get the Baltimore Sun. And I would bring this in, and there would be a sports page, and it was my favorite thing. They had a page with all the NFL matchups for that day with little helmets on each one and their records and a little description. And I would go in and I would circle the helmet of the team that I thought was going to win and write down the score. And this was just like my thing from, I would spend hours looking at the same stats page in the newspaper. And I've always just loved this. And it's so cool now that we can get this insanely abundant source of data, and it's freely available. And not only do they have this basic data that you would see in a newspaper, they've got that at a 10x scale in terms of tracking players or tracking advanced stats. So a couple of years ago, my friend Shri and I just said, okay, we both love, you know, sports data. We're both full-time developers. Let's combine our what we know here into a sports analytics site. So the entire idea here is very much data-driven, thoughtful sports analysis in comparison to what a lot of times is, you know, these hot takes that get a lot of traffic, but are not necessarily the longer lasting sports analytics, and combine this with some really cool data visualization, just as a place to use what we learn and create some unique and fun stuff.
Yeah, I've seen the visualizations. I know you published to Twitter, but also on Reddit. You've been on the subreddit Data is Beautiful before?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's Reddit is interesting, right? It's always interesting for marketing. It seems like it's random, but some of this stuff really pops off, you know, gets tens of thousands of views and sends thousands of users to the site. And then some of it just flops. I swear you could post the same thing in back-to-back days and one would get upvoted to the clouds and then the other one would just drop dead. But you had some really good success there. It's always encouraging when people recognize what you're doing and give you some words of encouragement, especially because it's not something that we monetize. So to do that and to get positive feedback and to see people are liking what we put out is always really encouraging.
I think you guys are currently projecting the kind of season-long race for MVP based on statistics.
Yeah, we do. So we do the NBA MVP, and the model is based on how previous voters voted. So a lot, particularly with the NBA MVP, there is this kind of narrative-based voting, which is a lot of times gets called out, or all of the votes are made public. So after the season ends, all of the voters, they have to reveal who they voted for. And I think because of that, there's really been, in the last 10 years, a lot of narrative-based voting. For instance, pretty famously, one year it was LeBron James was, by all stats and previous comparisons, probably should have been the MVP. Derrick Rose won it that year because, I mean, in large part, LeBron had won it back-to-back years before, a little bit of voter fatigue. This awesome story with Derrick Rose. So it's the model that we developed is an attempt to basically pull the narrative out of it and say, okay, just based on the stats, based on the team standings, some other advanced stats, who do we think the MVP would be this year?
And who do you have currently projected?
Pains me to say because I'm a Sixers fan, but currently Jokic is once again projected to win.
All right. Well, back to your day job. Now you're currently founder and CTO at Churnkey. What are you up to there?
So the origin story of this was it started as an internal project at Wave, which was the podcast marketing tool. And with Wave, we had a massive churn problem. Our churn month over month was like 11 to 13%. So as much money as we would pour into growth and trying to get new users, it would basically just drop right out the other side of the funnel. And we spent a lot of time internally at Wave trying to figure out what to do about this. We ended up hiring external consultants for tens of thousands of dollars and paid them to tell us what to do, you know, help us with this churn problem. And none of it really moved the needle. And eventually we built something in-house, which was a dynamic cancel flow. So you will see this with the biggest tech companies. In fact, we borrowed ours basically from Audible. We saw what they were doing, where when you try to cancel, they will ask why you're canceling, figure out why, but also based on those responses, give you an offer to encourage you to stay, whether it's, you know, a temporary pause or a temporary discount or credits or whatever it may be. And we saw a lot of these big successful companies are doing this. And it's like, why are we not doing this? So we built something in-house, which was basically version one of what is now Churnkey, where it would take people through a cancel flow and figure out why they're canceling and allow you to easily give them an offer to incentivize them to stick around. And the numbers we saw from that were, I thought they were wrong. I genuinely thought the numbers were wrong. It was the point where it's like, okay, people want to cancel, they're going to cancel. But no, a lot of times this is an opportunity to refresh the relationship with the customer. Clearly, you know, they signed up for this, they want to use it, and something happened where they're not getting the same value that they used to get out of it. So what can we do to make that relationship right? And sometimes it's they just need to pause, right? They're not using the product right now, they'll come back later. Other times, you know, if something went wrong, you can offer a discount to say, okay, we understand something might have gone wrong, especially now with the recession, the current economic situation. A lot of people, you know, their budgets are tighter than they used to be. So being able to position your company as the understanding company that, you know budgets are tight right now, let's meet you in the middle, give you a couple months of a discounted plan, can be a really effective way to boost retention.
So I remember back in the day, the credit card companies had these folks called the Tiger Team. And when you would try to cancel your credit card on the phone, you would get transferred to the Tiger Team. They would try to talk you out of it or drop your annual percentage rate or waive your annual fee and so on. So this seems like an interesting automation of the Tiger Team. And the other thing I like about it is that, you know, it's kind of the old eat your own dog food. Like, you guys were your first customers and you saw how this worked and said, oh yeah, like, I believe in this. So now, I think I saw a tagline, you guys are protecting $1 billion of ARR and subscriptions.
Yeah, first on the Tiger Team, that's a cool name, but it's funny. I was trying to cancel my parents' DirecTV account and they will not let you off the phone. So I ended up telling them, I was like, hey, I'm moving. And this was the one line. It was like the secret silver bullet that I finally pressed, and they just hung up after that. So that was great. Yeah, we tried to not make cancellation difficult, but, you know, make it, and like I said, like an opportunity to refresh the relationship, make it personalized cancel flow. But with regards to our growth in the first 2 years, it's definitely been really cool to see. It's a product that, since the initial launch, is something that all of us have been very proud of. We've definitely taken the approach of we want this to be a polished product from start to finish. And I know that kind of goes against a lot of startup advice right now. A lot of the advice just tells you to launch early, launch often. And there's this one phrase that makes its rounds, which is, if you are not ashamed of what you just launched, you waited too long. And I don't find that to be true in the slightest. I think, especially as developers, there is a tendency to not want to market things or not want to brag about these things. So what I find is almost just the opposite, where I want to be proud of what I'm working on and feel comfortable sharing it. And I want to feel comfortable telling people, yeah, you should use this, right? This is something that I built and it's going to work and you're not going to run into any problems. So I want you to use this. So yeah, since the start, it's been something that we used internally. So it got a lot of vetting there, but we made sure that this was not going to run into any issues. You know, it was something that looked good to the end customer. And I think looking back at the first 2 years now, it's what I'm most happy about is just how excellent the product is. And that sounds crazy to say, but it's, I mean, now a portion of any company's revenue comes from how good the product is, and a portion comes from how good your marketing is. And I'm always happy to say that I think most of our success has come from how good our product is.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard the same phrase, you know, fail fast or get it out there. Or if you aren't slightly embarrassed about your first release, you've waited too long. But you have to do something well. Like, you can't just put a flaming pile of garbage out there and cross your fingers. Like, maybe it's limited in scope, but you got to do that thing well or else no one's sticking around.
Yeah, it's so important, especially as a small team or a solo team, to find a niche. And if you don't have the resources to do that niche well enough, then make it smaller and smaller until you do, and you can provide something of value to at least some people, and then use that to branch out. So for us with Turnkey, we knew our team is small, we're bootstrap, and we need to release something that's quality, especially with billing code, right? You need these people to trust you 100% because you're dealing with their billing code. And so what we did is we very consciously made decisions on where we're going to limit what we build. So for instance, we did not build anything other than a Stripe integration until our second year. We just worked with Stripe. And by doing that, we were able to focus on it and build a better product for that. Then eventually when year two comes around and we're in a better position, okay, now we can build a ChargeBee integration, Braintree and Paddle. But being very conscious of where can we focus our energy and where can we, you know, push things off, and making those decisions in a deliberate way, especially as a small team, has been really important.
Yeah. And you mentioned when we talked on the pre-call about, you know, kind of agonizing about decisions when you start out, like which technology should I use? And you said that pruning the decision tree and trying to make it so you don't have to make a lot of decisions is extremely helpful. What did you mean by that?
Yeah. As technology people, there is always new technology and it is tempting to try it. And in fact, like, I would never discourage anyone from trying it. I do, you know, weekend projects and I try out new things, and because sometimes it is a substantial upgrade. But I think for when the focus is not on learning and the focus is on building, it's really important that you don't hit decision fatigue, especially if you're working solo or with a small team. For instance, with Vue versus React, I chose Vue for Wave, and I just continue to use it for Turnkey. The other thing with Vue versus React, I find is, and this is a little bit of a personal take, but with Vue, you get kind of the entire ecosystem, right? You get Vuex, you get Volar, the dev tools. And with React, which is a, you know, sometimes a pro, sometimes a con, there is, for every thing that you need to make a decision on, there's five different options. You definitely hit decision fatigue, I think, with the React ecosystem much more quickly than with Vue. By choosing Vue and choosing technology that we already worked on, we very much prune the decision tree of trying to eliminate any decision fatigue that you've run into. And I will say, like, some decisions, if I could go back and change them, I would change them. But the interesting thing is that it hasn't really made a big difference on day to day. Like, I would say, for instance, one of the biggest decisions you make building a code base is the database to use. And we use Mongo because that's what we use with Wave. And we already had a bunch of boilerplate code written. And if I could go back now, I would use relational database. I'd probably use Postgres. day to day, we use Mongo every day. And the thing is, now I can just write better Mongo aggregation pipelines instead of writing SQL queries. And it doesn't impact the day-to-day progress and how productive and effective you can be in nearly as big of a way as I think we think when we're first making these decisions of what technology to use.
Now, you mentioned frameworks and databases, but as far as tools go, you're a big fan of Copilot?
I do. And I think, I probably save, I would say somewhere between 5 and 20 hours of coding work per month. I probably code for 30 hours a week. And so 5 to 20 hours a week is nothing to shy away from. It's definitely significant and it's good at some things and it's not as good at some other things. I mean, sometimes it will give you code that looks right, but isn't necessarily right. But I think that's, I mean, our job as developers to know that and recognize that. And what I think it is especially good at is taking like pattern recognizing and figuring out, okay, you know, this code here is going to work down here, and taking a lot of basically increasing our typing speed, right? So it's we know we need to type this thing, and we know this either the small function needs to exist or we need to copy the settings from this file to this other file. So some of that more monotonous code, which can, again, coming back to the energy, it can really drain our energy just typing out this monotonous code. Like if I know what I want to say in code form, any time that it takes to actually type that out can be very frustrating. And I think that's where the future of AI, I hope, on the developer side, is to contract this time it takes to go from knowing very precisely how something should be implemented to the actual implementation of that code.
Yeah, it's very well suited for greenfield code production, for sure. That it's like, you know, strapping on these big robot arms that help you crank out code faster and reduce the time you spend in the doldrums of a context switch. Like, all right, get all this in place so I can finally do the thing I want to do. It's definitely harder to use with existing code because it kind of has to understand what's there. But Mike Bro, previous underserved guest, is also a huge fan of Copilot. We were thinking of doing a special episode where we kind of show off how it works one of these days.
That would be very cool. I'll tell you what, I was using it for a HubSpot integration this past weekend, and I haven't worked with the HubSpot API, and I don't really feel like going out and pulling out their API docs to figure out what exactly these functions are called. So Copilot was just, bam, tab, done. So it's really good for integrating with these integrations, which have been done time and time again, but you haven't done them specifically. So that's a really cool use case where instead of going out and needing to search API docs, the code is actually basically written for you by Copilot.
Now, AI in general is very hot. ChatGPT is all the rage these days. What is your kind of take on what it can do and where it's headed?
Yeah, to start with the Copilot, the extension of that, I think where this will go next is a prompt to pull request capability. So right now, it's very much in its predictive modeling state where it's working within the bounds of a single file, and it's working specifically within the bounds of what do you think these next 5 or 10 lines of code should say? I mean, this is definitely the next generation in terms of what it can do. But I think where it goes from here is, okay, now can you take an entire code base, you know, multiple files, work across this? Can I give you a prompt, a feature request as somebody would define it? And can you give me suggestions on where I should add code in different files to add this feature? And the interesting thing about this is GitHub, obviously, it's the perfect training set for this. It's got hundreds of thousands of pull requests and the code that it changes. And there's even some data on if there is linked pull requests between different repos. So I think they're in a good position in terms of training data, in terms of what they've got with Copilot now. Obviously, there's this huge open-ended question of how easy is this? And the interesting thing with AI is we clearly don't have a very good idea of how difficult things are. Some things have come much quicker. I think with the advancement of language models in particular, these seem like they stagnated, and then all of a sudden, wow, we're in a different place now. Versus like autonomous vehicles, which we thought was going to be an easier problem, I think, than it actually is with computer vision. And that's something where, you know, with all these edge cases has taken longer than we expected. So I think with AI, there's this pretty clear pattern of we don't have a good idea of how long things are going to take. So I do think with Copilot doing something like a prompt to pull request capability, it needs to take into account this broader context. It goes from a single file to many different files, which are all interworking. So I think it's an interesting use case. The feasibility of it is something we'll hopefully see in time.
And how would you say your data visualization methodology kind of pertains to other aspects of life and business?
So I've always loved data visualization. It's this crossover between data, which is great, give me any data, and this creative aspect. And what I found is that humans have this awesome ability for different things, whether it's pattern matching or dealing with trends. And I think the best data visualizations help people to see the data and put it into their own mental models and work with it from there. So instead of telling people directly, hey, this is the trend, instead you show people the data and you let them form it in their own head. And it's this different aha moment. It's this different epiphany that you get when you're the one actually putting together the patterns yourself. It just connects with you at a deeper level. So I think with data visualization, I always come back to show, don't tell. And this is very common within, you know, cinematography or novel writing, is this concept of show, don't tell. And I've definitely found this to be true within making data visualizations, which can really connect with people.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're good at finding patterns as humans, and you kind of want to play to that strength, right?
Exactly. We have so much built-in capability. So the more you can play into that, the better.
All right. So any hobbies that you were into when younger or today?
Yeah, aside from the data analytics sports side of things, I love photography. And I think part of this is just being able to capture a moment. And the fascinating thing to me about photography is that it's very different from seeing things. So we can be out in front of a beautiful sunset over the ocean. And so many times you go to take a picture of it with your phone and you look at the picture and it really just doesn't do it justice. So there's this fascinating thing where taking a picture is very different than seeing some things. And what's fascinating with photography to me is figuring this out. And how do we frame things? How do we paint it in a way that is, a lot of times, comes back to being able to tell a story. So kind of focus on the tree instead of the forest, which has always been an interesting problem for me.
Now, you had one of the most wholesome stories ever and how you got into photography.
So when I was a kid, I would go around with my friends and we had two little disposable cameras back in the golden days. And we would go run around and try to take pictures of gophers. And so I'm from a pretty small town, so there's not a lot going on to take pictures of, but there are gophers. And so we would go out on the trail, sunny summer days, have great memories of this, and go out and we called it gopher hunting, but obviously it's not gopher hunting. It was just going out and hunting for gopher pictures. And it was just, I think it was just having so many good memories of that definitely spurred on my photography hobby that I have now.
That's great. Well, you can hunt with a camera and it's much more sustainable.
That it is.
All right. Well, Rob, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
It's been a delight to talk with you, Andrew. Thanks so much for having me.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.